This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
I was mayor of Indianapolis for 16 years, and that was plenty for me and for the people, I think. But in my work at ULI, the Urban Land Institute, I'm writing a book on inner ring suburbs. And my travels found me not too long ago up in the Twin Cities area, meeting with what they call the I-35 West Coalition, which is a coalition of suburbs on the west side of Minneapolis along the corridor, the I-35 West Corridor. And these people, there are about 80 of them in the room, and they're all poring over a bunch of maps. The coalition had already developed a GIS system for these seven communities that were banded together in this coalition. And they were poring over the GIS maps, trying to figure out how they should grow, not as individual communities, but as a collective community. It was fascinating to see them moving chips around and saying, we think we ought to have parks and green space here. We think over here we should have higher densities and maybe multifamily. Over here we should have commercial. Over here we should have single family. And over here we should have mixed use and so forth. And they were plotting out their future so that their future wouldn't just happen. And so that their planning, their comprehensive approach to land use would bear fruit in positive results and not just more and more unplanned sprawl. And I was very impressed by that. And I think out of that comes to me a certain impression of what the realities are that we have to deal with. If we're going to talk about successful cities and sustainable cities and how to make our cities more livable and places more worthy of affection. And there are three realities that jumped out at me while I was at that meeting. The first one had to do with our interdependence, with regionalism. We have discovered that no longer do the old industrial age models apply of how cities work and how they develop. That is, in a series of concentric rings moving out from the center. We no longer have what you might call a heliocentric city with the sun in the middle, i.e. the central city, and lots of suburbs around it, all of which are dependent upon the central city as the place where everybody works. Now there has been a diaspora. Now there has been a dispersion. Now there has been the development of what you might call a metropolitan mosaic or a constellation, where in a constellation you don't have one central sun with a lot of planets orbiting around it, but you have stars here and there and everywhere. And that's the way it is in metropolitan America today. There's that interdependence, and municipalities are realizing that they can't go it alone, even if they're strong municipalities, as this one obviously is, being the eighth largest city in the United States. But they're realizing that that boundaries no longer count for very much. I remember the one time when I came out here for an Urban Land Institute meeting in San Diego, and I was shown a map of San Diego and Tijuana, and it didn't have a border line on it. You live in a borderless region. They talk about Port Coover up at the other end of the West Coast, from Portland up to Vancouver, and how meaningless and irrelevant boundary lines have become. Where does the suburb stop? Where does it start? Where does the central city end? Where does exurbia start? Where do the various different rings of suburbs, first, second, and third rings, if you please, start and stop? You don't know. It all sort of has melded into each other. And there are all kinds of cross-cutting issues as a consequence. Three questions have to be asked as we face the fact of regionalism. The first has to do with land use and whether or not we're planning together, because you can't plan alone. Let me read you an email I got from somebody who's the government affairs director for the Realtor Association of Greater Fort Lauderdale. He read something I'd written. He wrote, South Florida can probably be a good example of bad land use. The three counties, Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade, are expected to have 6.7 million new residents by 2030, and there's very little land left. For the community to have any chance of absorbing these people, we need to foster an environment that is conducive to redevelopment, especially with urban landfill. And then he goes on to talk about that at some length. Land use planning is a regional issue, as is transportation planning. A second whole group of issues has to do with fiscal disparities and how it is that there are haves and have-nots in a metropolitan area, and what is the obligation of the one to the other. They deal with this up in the Twin Cities where they have tax-based sharing. And 40%, as probably many of you know, 40% of the increment on new development in that eight-county area around the Twin Cities is put into a pot. The revenues are put into a pot and then redistributed on a basis of population and age of housing stock and several other factors by the Metropolitan Council, the Met Council as it's called. So that they do tax-based sharing there, but it's politically very volatile because many, many suburbanites say, I don't care about what's happening in the city. It's not my problem. I don't want my money going there. And yet that's an attempt, I think a courageous attempt, by the Minnesota State Legislature to level the playing field. A third kind of question that has to be asked has to do with how you deconcentrate poverty, because it seems to me that one of the issues that we're facing as a country is the concentrations of poverty in the central cities with all the pathologies that that connotes. Whereas if you deconcentrate it, I think you've got a better chance of solving one of our critical urban problems, which is the connection between poverty and low performance in schools and high crime rates. So there are these regional issues that have to be discussed, and we have to work on a regional basis. In Indianapolis, where I used to serve as mayor, we forged a non-aggression pact with our neighbors in the surrounding counties. And this was a pact that was signed by Indianapolis and its more suburban neighbors, promising that they would not try to cannibalize each other so far as economic development projects were concerned. You get into this insane ratcheting up of demand, and one bids so much in terms, like 10 years of tax abatement, well, I'll give you 15 if you'll come to me, I'll give you 20, and so forth. And it's just an insane way of doing business. So in Indianapolis, they've signed this non-aggression pact, which says we won't try to outbid our neighbor. It's a form, I think, of regionalism at its best. A second reality, if regionalism is the first, a second reality is density. That came through very clear as I was listening to those people talk and pore over their maps. Where are we going to have higher densities? Because we've got to have them. Just no question about it. This town, this city, which 100 years ago the mayor said he hoped it would get to 10,000 someday in population, is going to have a million more people in what, another 18 years by the year 2020? Or is that too far out? California is going to have, what, 16 million more? And the United States is going to have 60 million more, which is the population of California and Texas combined. Those people are going to have to go somewhere. They're going to have to live somewhere. We're going to have to learn the lesson of higher density. We're going to have to learn that density is not a four-letter word. It's got seven letters in it. And you can't be against sprawl and against density at the same time. It's just impossible. So we have to recognize that higher densities are going to be the order of the day. And that means we're going to have to make a commitment to mass transit, not to the exclusion of road building, but we're going to have to do more with mass transit. We're going to have to do more with infrastructure. We're going to have to do more with conservation of existing stock. And we're going to have to do more with urban design and urban planning. And I'm glad that the director of the Department of Urban Planning is here tonight with some of her colleagues. The governor of Maryland, Paris Glendening, who's one of the leaders in the smart growth movement, says combining two core elements of smart growth, namely density and quality design, can go a long way toward creating the types of communities more and more Americans want to call home. Communities worthy of our affection. Design must reinforce a sense of community. One of the tragedies that we have faced in America with sprawling development has been a loss of a sense of place and a loss of sense of community. And I know that sometimes when you say something like that, you're criticized for being too glib. But I think it's true. Delton Young is a psychologist up in Seattle who specializes in adolescence. And he said something which I think is very profound, and I'm going to read it to you. What provides young people with strength and resilience against destructive influences is personal connections with family members, neighbors, teachers, and other stable adults. Yet everything about the way our suburban towns are built discourages cohesion among families, neighbors, and communities. The typical configurations of these towns undermines the kinds of connections that help protect young people from risk. These suburbs have been built not by design to meet the human needs of children and families, but by default to accommodate the demands of economic growth, more jobs, greater population, and the lure of expanded tax bases. And he suggests that the answer lies in providing the traditional American town feelings of coherence and a sense of place, a town center with public open space and local businesses and a place to gather, which pushes us toward the question of urban design. Some people call it new urbanism, some people call it new traditionalism, some people call it smart growth. The National Governors Association has come out with a very illuminating a study of this. It's called NCD, New Community Design, to the rescue, it says. Well, there are basic principles involved in all these movements, regardless of what you call them. And I think as a result of that, the dialogue, the nature of the dialogue is being changed so far as urban planning is concerned. Because now these kinds of principles are important. Use compact design. Rebuild the old before building the new. Mix your land uses. Create a range of housing opportunities and choices. About one-third of Americans want to live in places that embody new community design, the governors say, with a focus on real neighborhoods, a strong sense of community, walkable streets, and less dependence on cars. But less than 1% of housing offers such mixed-use places. Got to do something about that. Mix our land uses, create a range of housing opportunities, preserve open space and habitat, provide variety and transportation choices, foster walkable, close-knit neighborhoods, promote a strong sense of place, encourage stakeholder involvement, as you're doing so well. I mean, like this meeting here tonight, and we'll get to the questions pretty soon. I'm mindful of the old adage that the mind can only absorb as much as the seat can endure, and or to paraphrase Henry VIII to one of his six wives, don't worry, I won't keep you too long. We've got to dialogue and engage the community. So I speak of regionalism, I speak of density, and then thirdly, diversity. It's a truism now, but America is becoming a multi-ethnic society. You all know this here better than many of us know it who live out there in the hinterland, although I speak of Indianapolis. In Washington, it has become much more diverse, ethnically speaking. And we have to learn as a country and as communities to embrace diversity as a core strength and not say, oh, isn't it terrible? Or we've got to change it, because it won't change. It's here to stay. And that means we have to provide more housing choices in our communities if they're going to be sustainable. And that means we're going to have to think more than we do about workforce housing, affordable housing, some people call it, attainable housing. There are 3 million working families in America that have critical housing needs, according to the National Housing Conference, based in Washington. And they define critical housing needs as either living in severely substandard housing or spending more than half of their income on housing. And there's a whole lot of people out there, a lot of municipal workers, firefighters, trash picker-uppers, police, teachers, people in the middle of the economic ladder who particularly here in California maybe can't afford to live closer in. So they're forced to go farther and farther out in sprawl-inducing low-cost housing. That's why up in San Carlos outside of San Francisco, the city council recently voted to lend $100,000 interest-free to their city workers so that they could buy a place in San Carlos and wouldn't have to commute 40 miles to work. In Minnetonka, Minnesota, the mayor told me there's 7 people on the city council there, and if they all had to buy their own house today, 6 of the 7 couldn't afford it. Couldn't afford it. Minnetonka, Minnesota. We have to provide a range of housing choices. There's nothing wrong with suburbia. Please don't misunderstand me. But there's more on the smorgasbord of housing, or there should be, than just single-family units on great big pieces of property. What about multifamily? What about condos? What about affordable housing? What about rentals? All the rest of it, you know. It all fits in. And we're going to have to talk also, if we're talking about diversity, about how can we in communities create more social capital? How can we overcome the danger of what one author has called bowling alone? How can we meet the challenge of connecting and reconnecting with people? What can we do to facilitate that? As some of your benchmarks, which I'll get to in a minute, encourage us to do. I know a lady in, she's a very interesting lady in Lincoln Heights, I think it is, which is a very, very poor suburb outside of Cincinnati. Incorporated after World War II, at one time advertised itself as the largest black city in America, all African American. And I went up and rang this, I didn't know who she was, I walked up on her porch and rang a doorbell because she was living in a rehabbed house, and I was interested in a rehabbed house. And she opens the door, and I come in, and she offers me some lemonade and so forth on a hot summer day. We sit down on her porch, and we started talking. I said, ma'am, if you'll pardon me, I don't mean to ask you a personal question, but I thought this was an all-African-American community, and you're white. She said, I'm not white. She said, I'm multiracial. Then she told me her lineage. She said, on my father's side, I go back 59 generations to Johann Sebastian Bach. My maiden name was Bach. And on my mother's side, I go back to Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. She said, I'm multiracial, which means I'm discriminated against by both sides. But she told me that she had founded a group called Diversity, in which she had sought to bring people together. Some were homeless, some were entrepreneurs, some were African American, some were white, some were rich, some were poor, etc. But she brought this group together. I said, what do you do together? She said, we make poetry together. They all write poetry. And I think that's a beautiful expression, making poetry together. How can we facilitate making poetry together in our communities? What all this adds up to is not an indictment of suburbia at all. 80% of American people want to live in suburbia. Okay. But it's a call to change the paradigm from quantitative to qualitative development, based, I think, on 4 principles: mixed uses, preserving land and maximizing usable green space, providing transportation choices so that we're not just dependent on the car and we have other options, and providing a range of housing opportunities. The National Governors Association has prepared a checklist, which I won't take time to read now, but it's very good, and I commend it to you, for seeing if these principles are applied. Let me just read you the first couple. Is there a mix of housing, office space with significant employment opportunities, schools, retail, shopping, outdoor recreation areas, and civic public spaces and buildings? These are a checklist of questions you have to ask before you approve a project. Does the housing include different types of homes? And so forth and so on. There's 24 of those questions, and they're good questions. But you talk about it in terms of benchmarking, which is the same thing as the NGA is talking about. And I think it's wonderful that you're trying to measure your progress toward sustainability. and livability and creating places worthy of our affection, whether they're town centers or villages or whether they're an entire city or whether it's a suburban development or a near neighborhood. And you can measure these things so that, if you want to put it this way, you get a time chart flowing out to, say, 2020. And you ask questions like this. How much has regional cooperation increased in this time frame? Have we been able to get one regional mass transit authority for this area, as the mayor wants to, according to his State of the City speech? Have we been able to get a new regional airport in this period of time? Those are benchmarks. Or what about density? That's not too hard to measure. I'll bet you, and we tried to look up the figure with the help of your librarian before this meeting began, density figures for San Diego, but I'd be willing to bet dollars and donuts that there was greater density in the city of San Diego, like every other American city, in 1950 than in the year 2000 per square mile. Because of sprawl. There is. All right, you found out. Good. Well, she's my documentation. Thank you for the factual backup. We can measure mass transit and reduce traffic congestion very easily between now and 2020. What's the percentage of ridership on mass transit? Has it gone up? What about new means of transit? The trolleys and sophisticated bus systems and light rail or rubber rail, however you want to put it. You can measure affordable housing. Is there more affordable housing in 2020 than there is today? Are there mixed income communities developing? I think mixed income is the way to go, like Hope 6, for example, which is a small pilot that HUD started, but I think it makes a lot of sense because that gets at that question of deconcentration of poverty. Or what about mixed uses? We talked a little bit this afternoon about code enforcement. Code enforcement is very important. Every single place that I visited in connection with my research for this book on inner ring suburbs, they talk about how we've got to enforce the codes, whether it has to do with weeds and trash and cars abandoned in lots or whether it has to do with the condition of buildings. And they've also got to update their zoning codes. I had a person say to me the other day, you know, if our main street burned down today, we couldn't rebuild it because of the parking requirements and the street width requirements and all these other things that come out of an old industrial model back in the 20s and 30s when our codes were originally written. We have to have more flexibility. We have to permit non-conforming uses in our codes. You can measure how you're doing in code enforcement. I had a lady in Harvey, Illinois. She's the director of development there, bragged to me that, by golly, she told her code enforcement officers they had to bring in 100 citations a week. And then we fine them and go after them. Now, she's measuring code enforcement in her city. Acquisition of open space can be measured. Energy savings can be measured. And this building's a wonderful example of how energy can be saved. This is a national model. And you deserve that national recognition that you receive. Crime statistics can be measured. Increase in social capital is a little harder, but you can measure how kids are doing in school, how SAT scores are going. You can measure, I guess, how many arts festivals you have because music and art are universal languages that bring us all together. You can measure library use, the number of people that are coming in. You can measure out here, and I think this is part of it because folks that swim together won't fight each other probably. You can measure how many times the beach is closed during a given year here, which the mayor talked about in his State of the City speech. He wants to reduce it. I was astounded. He said 300 days a year one of the beaches is closed around here. Too much. You can reduce that. You can figure out how the community centers are being used. You can figure out how many trees you have in the streetscapes and how much street furniture you're using and benchmark all that. And you can also, of course, benchmark economic development, the number of jobs, the growing tax base, and so forth. There's a lot that you can benchmark, and I think you're doing a great job with your benchmarking program. And I think you have a wonderful mayor and a wonderful city staff. And I really feel as though you're on the right track, and all I can say is keep on keeping on. But let me leave you with a better quote than that. I used to be a congressman. I wasn't a congressman for very long, just 2 years. I discovered the first chance that they had to express themselves. So many people in Indianapolis missed me that 51% of them voted for me to come home, which I took as quite a compliment. But during the time I was there, I was at the bottom of the totem pole, you know, for two reasons. One, I was a freshman, and two, I was a Republican. And you didn't get any lower on the totem pole in the 1970s than that if you're a member of Congress. So I had a lot of chance to listen, even though I told the people back home that I was always standing up on the floor shouting for them and advocating their causes, which wasn't true. But one day my mind was sort of wandering around, my mind's eye was wandering, and I was like in church on Sunday morning, you know, when you get a little bored, you start counting the number of panes of glass in the stained glass windows, or if you're bored tonight, you've counted the number of acoustical tiles in the ceiling. Well, up above the speaker's chair, up above the American flag and back of the speaker's chair, up above the frescoes of Lafayette and Washington, the United States House of Representatives, up above the engraving in marble, "In God We Trust," up above the press gallery, there's a saying engraved in the keystone of the United States House of Representatives, which caught my eye one day. Right there where the wall and the ceiling come together. And it's a phrase or a statement from Daniel Webster, who said this: "Let us develop the resources of our land, call forth its powers, build up its institutions, promote all its great interests, and see whether or not we also in our day and generation may not accomplish something worthy to be remembered." And I think that you all, us all at ULI, most Americans are trying to accomplish something worthy to be remembered, are trying to keep faith with the mission that they had last Monday before the tragedies hit, and which they still have. And it's got to be our resolve and our prayer that these missions, which are good missions, that have to do with responsible land use and with building better communities and making it a better place in which to live and work and raise a family, that these missions will not perish in the flames of a tragedy like last Tuesday. So, my time is up. Thank you very much.